so much has happened and so many cross currents. But let me ask you this, is there any way to review this? You know, as we go on in questions and answers, two things can happen. One can be just a misplacement in time or in connection that one might want to correct it on. Once the memory is stirred up by the question, one thinks, oh, the other is one simply forgot something and say, oh God, I should have mentioned that.
Well, you can get a hold of me through Ralph. You'll know where I am. I'm at the University of Alabama.
Okay.
Dates aren't very important. And when I teach, I do a lot of teaching. And when I teach students, I'm not interested in the dates that things happen. I'm interested in some kind of order, because it's a sequence of events. But I don't care whether they say it's 61 or 64, I'm figuring that out in an overall chronology. And so I'm more interested in your impressions and interpretations, and I'm interested in you opening things to me, which I can then go to the documentation and check. As you know, Marshall saved enough stuff to sink this building into the sand in so far as documentation.
I can imagine. Must be unbelievable.
I can't read all that. So I've got to get. I've got to start at the top of it.
Can ever anybody read all that? Will ever anybody? I can't imagine.
No,
it's unbelievable.
It is one of the paradoxes of the 20th century history. Yeah. So it's an embarrassment of riches. You have so much to do.
Yeah.
How do you select what you're going to look at?
And two, this won't be typed out and used verbatim at all. But as a material, if you are quoted at all, you won't have a chance to see it later. Mm-hmm. Our PR people will, me or somebody, will get a chance to read this, the whole thing, and comment on it. And we'll send copies to everybody that's involved in it. Mm-hmm. So you will have a chance.
Okay.
So feel a little free. Now, anytime you want, I'll turn it off.
Okay, fine.
So give them more freedom.
Okay. Well, do you have any particular questions?
Just ask all those questions. Oh, you can do it in an hour. You're just super good at it.
Well, let me say this. I personally have always taken the broadest possible approach to spaceflight. Spaceflight has always been two things for me, launch vehicle and spacecraft. I really have never completely separated them, and it has always meant to me exploration and application. I never separated these two things. In my first book, and back in 59, I made that point very strongly, and I pleaded for more emphasis on practical application along with the exploration, or one day we'll be stopped in the exploration. Unfortunately, some of this has happened now. We're turning around, but it is. So some of my thoughts will be dictated a little bit by this kind of frame of reference. In other words, I always have tried to think in very large integrated blocks rather than individual things. So when you see this trend, I just want to point that out. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, really, we got our feedback for the first time in modern history with a real quasi spacecraft, if you will, of precursory spacecraft, which was a V2, in this sense, that it had the kind of reliability that you needed for repeated launchings rather than the earlier tests, however ingenious they were, they had at best a 50-50 chance to run. Now this one for the first time was one which in a very rapid sequence was supposed to become a system that at any time could be launched by a properly but not excessively trained crew, whether by people who are normal human beings and not Nobel Prize winners or anything like that, or special inventors. Number one. Number two, for the first time an extensive amount of automatic guidance and control equipment was involved, which was almost completely absent in all the earlier things. The earlier things were essentially flying propulsion systems. That was about it. By and large, maybe a little bit of a generalization, they had very primitive direction devices. But for the first time, this one had a real full-fledged kind of automatic guidance control system, even though part of it was on the ground, but it was accurately corrected. Its design, very interestingly enough, the early design of the V2 attempted lightweight design, but it was always a self-supporting structure. I do remember that in early 42, when we fueled one V2, as you know, it had fins. There's one of them. The fins were buckled, actually. So that looked awfully dangerous. In those days, especially, we had really not a very good idea how far we could go. Mm-hmm. not off. Now this line of safe design, safe and relatively massive design, is perhaps the principal trademark of quote unquote the German team. And I'm an exception because I did not do that on Centaur. That had certain discussions that and discussions Vernon and Brown on this and so on and so forth. But you look at the Jupiter, you know, look at the Saturn, Sirius, very sturdily built. And the American line, the one to call it that, even though some of us were in on this one too, started off a little bit differently. Already Professor Obert in his book, and it's really difficult to do something that Obert Obert in his book suggested that maybe because he was very much aware, you know, Obert was a German goddess, he was very much aware of the importance of the mass ratio. And physics professors and other people in those days gave him a heck of a time in the 20s, late 20s and early 30s. He could never build something light enough to come up with the mass ratio or with the sufficient to send something in orbit. And he felt it could be done. He said one way it could be done is that if we improve our steel sufficiently so that we can make it so thin that we pressure stabilize it. He calls it balloon construction. And the American word is more technological, it's more pressure stabilized. Now, independent of Ober, this thought was developed by Dr. Bossert at Columbia. And when he worked on the MX-774 and the Atlas Eagle, the Atlas Eagle was indeed based on this kind of a structure. I talked to Dr. Bossert, with whom I worked very closely, with whom I'm a good friend, about it, and kidded him a little bit, but he honestly did not know this. This was strictly his own genius that came up with this idea. And when I saw that as I joined Condé, I liked it very much. I thought it was a good way to go. But for the very large vehicles, it was not found to be too acceptable. There were just too many qualms about the fears and apprehensions of a very difficult structural situation, especially if you have multi-stage vehicles. Although I was convinced it could be done at least on a two-stage vehicle of modest dimensions, and that's what became Centaur. Now Centaur, you see, what I wanted to do there, and the reason why I actually deviated from the heavier design line, in fact, actually was even a little bit bolder still than the Atlas one, was not really because I liked that kind of brainmanship so much, as more due to the fact that the smaller you become, the lighter must you build to maintain a certain mass ratio. Now, the oxygen-hydrogen propellant is terrific, but it's there because of its high specific impulse, but its value can be very easily degraded if your mass ratio isn't good. And that means, therefore, that especially in smaller time vehicles, oxygen hydrogen can practically be wiped out if you're not very careful. Therefore, very small rockets are just not suitable vehicles for the use of oxygen hydrogen. I was convinced to the point of that it became really almost a crusade for me that we had to move rather quickly to high specific impulse, high energy propellant, because that would be the only way in which we could make a real breakthrough towards spaceflight with our vehicles. And while the Air Force investigated a large number of advanced fuels, including fluorine and hydrazine and other things along these lines, I remember these days very vividly in the late 50s. People were surrounded by alternatives. As usual, there was no consensus what to do. I personally did continue to push for oxygen hydrogen for a very simple reason. Number one, oxygen technology we had. We had it from the V2 on. In the meantime, on the Atlas, we had it, and we had it on Jupiter, and we had it on the Thor. It was a well-developed technology. Now, so therefore, only one new fuel had to be done. The more we went to fluorine and the new fuel, we had to develop also fluorine technology with all the poisonousness and the messy thing that goes with it. And it wasn't really necessary because when you were at oxygen kerosene, oxygen RP1, and went to oxygen hydrogen, you made already 92 to 93% of the jump that you could possibly make, even if you would go to fluorine hydrogen. So for the last 5 or 7% to go through a completely new oxidizer, regardless of what its advantages of density and all this work, seemed to me to make very little sense. To go to a new fuel, to a new oxidizer, but keep the same fuel, didn't give you much of a performance increase. The second reason why I went to hydrogen rather than hydrazine or anything like this was simply because I was convinced from my work that I had already done in Finland that the time of the nuclear-propelled spacecraft would not be far away. Perhaps even nuclear-propelled launch vehicle is not in those days, even in terms of that. And the only working fluid that makes sense with nuclear heat exchange rockets is hydrogen. Your specific impulse deteriorates very rapidly the moment you go away from hydrogen, go to hydrazine or anything like that, or ammonia. So it wasn't very worthwhile to try anything but hydrogen. So it seemed to me so logical to use the hydrogen that, that I could never really be very interested in any other solution. On top of it, there were obvious advantages in air breathing. And while these things were helpfully classified, one couldn't talk much about it, those of us familiar with jet propulsion could very easily deduce that if we were to replace gasoline by hydrogen, that we could build aircraft with fantastic performance compared to diesel. So it seemed, everything seemed to me in spacecraft or aircraft ultimately to go to hydrogen. But hydrogen is a nasty stuff, a difficult stuff to handle, very cold, very elusive, very evaporative, and in small rockets, it had that problem. Now, I didn't believe that we could justify the development of a completely new large rocket vehicle based totally on oxygen, hydrogen. People were not that convinced that hydrogen would work, and I felt the best way to break the door down, to begin to at least try the door open anyway, was to select a vehicle that would not be too big a development process, like another Atlas or even something bigger into the multi-billion dollar program, but something smaller. And at the same time, that would one that would fit on an existing booster. And so I started to look at this Atlas vehicle. So if we straighten this out, cylindrical, 10 foot diameter, it's not the ideal size for a high oxygen hydrogen vehicle, but it might just be large enough so I can get away with and solve the mass fraction, the mass ratio problem, if I am using pressurized structure and maybe drive that a little bit further. So I felt a synthesis of booster and large vehicle, a size that was reasonable to break into it, an experience with the pressurized structure that was available at Convair, it seemed to fit off. And so I went that route. And that route was, of course, quite divergent from the Huntsville route. We had many friendly discussions and many things that in those days that we argued about. And Huntsville themselves looked at their larger launch vehicles that they were checking into and investigating, also at the possibility of low weight structure. It had in the meantime come to the point that, let's say in the late 50s and early 60s, really I think the two top teams in the country at that time were the Marshall team and our Convair team. The Titan team began to come up, and there wasn't really a Boeing team or any other major rocket team. We were really the two major rocket teams. And the Huntsville team went the heavy structural route, and the Convair team was proud of the light structural route. They went that route. So many of our proposals were based on pressurized structure for upper spaces and Saturn later on. And so Huntsville had great trouble to accept this and eventually decided not to accept it fundamentally. And so the direction went in heavy. So that's one important difference perhaps that characterizes the whole situation. Now, the pressurized structure has proven itself fabulous. And if you look at the metamorphosis that the Saturn vehicle has gone through compared to what the somewhat malign Centaur has gone through, you will find that Centaur, even today, as applied, looks virtually the same as my department, my people, and I had it under the design board on the drawing board back in 59. And we proposed very little change. The Saturn vehicle had a different history. Initially, Marshall looked at very large boosters, completely new boosters. Then I think it was a suggestion of ARPA, if I remember correctly. But ARPA said, well, look, you have all those pretty nice sized Redstone and Jupiter. Can't you cluster those together? They had also looked at cluster, but different types of clusters. But most of them that I saw at that time were almost more like Saturn V type boosters, although they weren't in that size. They were more in the Saturn 1B size range, but they were S1C type stages, new stages, and so forth. And that caught on at Marshall, and they really went into this and said, yes, that looks really terrific. We can actually build a very nice and defty booster out of such an arrangement of Jupiter and Redstone around it. But then there was a question, what do we do for an encore now on the upper stages? Mm-hmm. And we had all wild things. And I used to tell them, Brown, you know, this, whatever you're doing, it's not going to work. It's not going to really have good performance unless it's centaur tipped. So we had that kidding with about the centaur tipped Saturn family. He says, I'm not sure whether that little flimsy little thing of yours is going to work. You would see, you need an oxygen hydrogen. You should really cluster oxygen hydrogen up there. Yeah, well, but it's, we have, it's such a big development program. We really shouldn't yet.
Were you worried about handling hydrogen?
Somewhat. Somewhat, but not too much. I remember that he asked me, like it was in 47 or so, somewhere in that file back in my house down there, that somebody had published an article at that time, I think, in the Journal of the American Rocket Society. I forgot at the moment the name. Anyway, which he proved that oxygen hydrogen was an excellent propellant. And I know Werner was a bit unhappy about, and he says, I don't think this is right. I want you to investigate and work out a comparative methodology for comparative analysis of rocket propellants. Now, but the point was, we weren't always necessarily that accurate in those days. You know, when these articles appeared or when these arguments came up, somebody might have meant for a spacecraft and talked also about a launch vehicle or somebody else or a launch vehicle or whatever it is. They saw different vehicles possibly. So I sat down and wrote this article. It was later on published in the Journal of the American Rocket Society. And the result basically really was, I introduced a number of parameters and so on. The result really basically was that indeed for certain conditions, heavier propellants were better, and for other conditions, lighter propellants were better. Okay, so on that we then kind of settled. Werner used to say, Werner is, and I say this with an offense, but he's fundamentally almost often more a conservative than an innovator. It took a long time for him to really accept the thought of a nuclear-powered hydrogen spacecraft. Remember, in his Mars story, he made a point using dense propellant. I remember that. I was a little bit hesitant. I worked the propulsion system out on his staff at that time for this Mars project that he had. And he wanted so very much to have dense propellant. He kept on saying, yeah, it's probably safer. God, if we get a hole punctured there on the way to Mars in a hydrogen tank, then everything is down the tube and so on and so forth. And so we settled at that time, so if I remember correctly, on wet fuming nitric acid and hydrazine, something like that. And I gave the engines high pressure, and I went to hydrazine to get some decent specific impulse out of this. And the thing went completely out of hand because the desire for dense propellant reduces specific impulse too much. So in any case, it was in those days that the situation started. And Werner, he was fully aware of the higher performance, and he liked it, but he felt that maybe the time wasn't come yet. So his original, all his original Saturn and the Saturn 15 were all based on denser propellants. Very reluctantly, he once looked at Atlas as a second stage, but then preferred Titan really as a second stage, which seemed to be sturdier and met more his conditions of non-pressurized structure and so forth. And I kept on at it. We had many meetings in those days, and in our friendship, you know, I kept on always saying that you need a centaur tip Saturn. Okay. And lo and behold, along came this And I still have some, I remember this, and I still have some pictures of it, by the way, of an unbelievable variety. The history, and you know that probably even better than I do, and probably have a document about it, the initial C1 and C2 and C3s, you know, it's murderously different from the final ones. So they went through tremendous changes at that time. And it wasn't really settled until until a committee was established. I think it was a joint NASA and DOD committee, which, as a result of our relatively good progress that was still before the first flight on Centaur, but the way we went ahead and designed it and the way the engine worked began to impress people. I said, my God, maybe it isn't so bad after all. Wasn't it done? Not
the Silverstein committee?
No, yeah, no, not Silverstein, no. It was
Kavanaugh.
I think Kavanaugh, either Kavanaugh or somebody like that. It was a joint DOD NASA, rather high level committee. It's possible that Silverstein was on it, but he was not the name carrying chairman of the committee was there. Anyway, their recommendation was forget about anything other than oxygen, hydrogen, upgradation. And it really did verify what basically was not so difficult to derive. My God, if you go through that trouble, build such a bigger vehicle, you know, you're practically defeating your purpose if you don't come up with oxygen and hydrogen. Okay, and that design, that then led to really the first Saturn one, where they said, well, look, you have now already, you have the Pratt & Whitney engines. Mm-hmm. And as a third stage, why not take the Centaur? So then you have a makeshift second stage with the, what was it, 8 or 10 or so Pratt & Whitney engines on it, or 12, yeah, six. Yeah,
it was designed for four, but they couldn't get it. So those upgraded, so they went back to the six.
That's right, with those six, mm-hmm. And which was kind of a super Centaur, really, very much designed after that. And then the Centaur on top.
Well, Doug was built there. Did they get information from that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. They got information from us. They visited us there after.
How much would you have to get?
I think practically everything they wanted to know, mm-hmm. They could get. There was not that kind of a competition. It wasn't, we developed it on government money, so we found it was government property and NASA should profit from it. Anyway, in the meantime, Centaur, which had a terrible history of top level management, was kicked around between ARPA and Air Force and NASA and their Milt Rosen. And, you know, NASA headquarters taking this over while NASA headquarters was in its formative stages. And everybody had his own idea about what should be done, which is unbelievable. You couldn't get any answers when you tried to get any decisions. Funding.
Von Braun was managing the Centaur for a while.
Von Braun, not until very later. And
then it went up to Lewis?
Yeah. Von Braun was the last stage. It started out with ARPA, and they couldn't find through, and then it went to the Air Force. And then the Air Force lost interest or they had other problems, and then it was kicked over to NASA headquarters. And NASA headquarters, Milt Rosen threw the Vega into this, and that deducted, because that was his pet project. Mm. He came out of the Hagen Vanguard stable there, and he had different ideas. And he wanted to have the Vega, and said, that's another new upper stage for Atlas. And instead of us developing one, so we had now the Vega. And the money for the Vega engine came largely out of the budget for the Centaur engine. We suffered severely because of these private. It's really this. Our development has in part been so damn costly because people had their personal projects. In other words, they could not withstand total criticism. They just were imposed by virtue of the high level of certain people. They said, well, this is what I want to do, and there's always, if you're high enough, there are enough people that scramble it. Oh, that's what he wants to do. Let's go and do it. You see, I don't really believe it, but let's go. You know? And whereas everything that came from further down had to really be argued through, and it had to be proven, and it had to stand up before it could go. So that was superimposed now over it, and as a result, the data didn't come, and the Centaur was severely disturbed, really severely disturbed. We had to drop tests and so forth. Later on in the hearings before Congress, we were blamed of not doing enough tests here and here. And yet, in one year, we lost what was something of the order of $10 or $15 million on testing alone that we couldn't do because money was converted off into the direction of Vega. But anyway, and so Rosen wasn't really very much interested. By the time it got to Marshall. Von Braun wasn't interested. It was really who ran it. Von Braun, basically, I think, couldn't kill him. He was busy with Setter. So yes, said Huda, Hans, you run that thing. I knew Hans, of course, from the days when we were, the fact you lit the candle under the V2, so I got along famously with Hans, and it was a really good time. But still, the proper management structure was not there, and it wasn't Marshall's baby. And Marshall is too creative a team to be able to absorb somebody else's creation. Always very difficult. Marshall is not a processor. Marshall is a creative team. You see, and creative people have difficulties just processing other people's material. That's always a conflict. Yeah. You see, that's why, for example, Marshall got along so famously on the first stage of Saturn, the S1C, with Boeing. Because Boeing, which was desperate in those days for business, went all out and said, we are here to please you. And my dear girlfriend, Razek, just absolutely loved that. You know, whereas he got from us often. Yeah, Dempsey and so forth. Yeah, Dempsey. There was one famous statement, which I was not in the room when it was made. And I'm even, I better don't say that even was felt and was very knowledgeable. And there was, of course, often, you know, we have our opinion, you have your opinion. And that's always very difficult. You should have creative teams, but don't force them on each other. You know, if your technological development of a nation as big and as active, as vigorous as the United States, has enough room, you know, to let them independently work. Now, Boeing in those days took a different tack at the whole thing. They said, well, now we want that business, and we know how to get it. We go to Verma, we go to Mrazek, and say, how do you want us to do it? Mrazek says, I give you all the drawings, you do it. And then before they, I understand, before they changed the crew, they went back and said, do you agree we move from here to here, or something like that. So it worked famously, and it probably was good that it worked this way, because if the Saturn would have been built between teams that were in conflict with each other, that had their own creative outlets and different approaches, there are always several ways to skin a cat. That may be practically equivalent, but you can't ultimately have only one way. Somebody has to make a decision, and the Marshall team was supremely capable of making that decision, and it was good that they worked with teams that said, well, you set the tone, and we'll do it, what you say. And that worked fine. So in the case of the Douglas situation, when Douglas was learning from us, maybe they wouldn't like me to put it this way, but they did get all the experience, obviously. And so did Marshall, incidentally, also. I mean, they came and we gave them anything we had. And once again, here, of course, Marshall is not the team to say, okay, this is the way they did it. Let us do it this way. They checked it independently. There was some feeling, and so did Douglas, there was some feeling, for example, that at least on the larger size second stage, it might be more desirable to have the insulation inside rather than outside. I didn't like too much adjustment in the insulation. Not that I was very happy with it. I had introduced it at that time for the very simple reason that I had desperately to fight for every edge I could get on the mass ratio. I wouldn't have made it. And there was no need for, under those, in those days, specified Air Force and NASA missions. There was no long storage time in it, to keep the insulation on after breakthrough through the atmosphere. So we threw it off. Didn't seem to be that terrible a problem. And at the end of the problem, we solved it, and it flies up every time. It's rather well. That's not one of the critical areas of things. Anyway, they had it inside, and these sorts of changes. Now, the moment you put it inside, you put it directly against the wall. You didn't have to fight with the helium layer that we had to have between the steel wall, pressurized structure, and the insulation. And it facilitated things on the one hand. On the other hand, it made it more difficult because the huge big structure was breathing, it was expanding and contracting. To make sure that this insulation didn't crack under those conditions and thereby opened up heat leaks, and of course was a pretty formidable one. So they changed really one problem for another and solved it beautifully. There were, in other words, there were differences. In other words, what I'm saying is that